Florida used to be a popular place for movies, and that's in large part due to the work of former Governor Bob Graham. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The former governor and U.S. senator is being recognized for his work in the film industry, basically helping the Sunshine State become one of the top states for TV and film projects. Graham will tell us what Florida needs to do to get back that recognition, but we'll also talk politics. Plus, a Broward judge is allowing a report on the confessed Parkland shooter to go public. We learn what it'll tell us about the school district's handling of the troubled teen's life. And K-pop, or Korean pop, has a loyal following globally, but not as much in South Florida. We meet the YouTube star JRE from Broward and learn about his passion for the K-pop music scene. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, there was another turn in the case of the confessed Parkland shooter. Last week, Broward Circuit Judge Elizabeth Scherer decided that a report put together by the school district on the shooter can be released to the public. It's a report that's supposed to show how schools, teachers, and the district handled the troubled teen throughout his education. Defense attorneys argued the information could hurt their client's ability to get a fair trial. We're joined now by Colleen Wright, education reporter for the Miami Herald. Colleen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Did this report tell us anything we didn't already know?
You know, it's first of all, it's very long, and what we learned is what they tried to block out. They redacted approximately 20 or so pages, and Emily Black at the Sun Sentinel actually discovered that it really wasn't redacted. And you know, when we saw her tweet, you know, we got to give her credit, but we copied all of that and put it in a Word document, and it's just kind of like a blow-by-blow take on Cruz's educational career in the Broward school system, and it confirms that he was kind of a loner. Not the best student, and he had a lot of ups and downs, and it's a lens into just how he spent his school years. It doesn't really go into safety or discipline necessarily, but how the school district tried to just work with him throughout the years. So it gives some details, not a lot of shocking revelations, because we learned a lot of that through interviews with former classmates and the people who knew him.
Were there any surprises?
It was a little surprising that, his mom really did kind of seem like an enabler. I know the Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Galteri has said before at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission that, his mother was an enabler, kind of let things happen. And she comes in here an often lot. She seemed to be always involved in his special education team meetings, but didn't really kind of threw her hands up when things got a little rough. She kind of just went along with whatever was going on. When things got really bad in high school, there's a note in here that, Nicholas Cruz asked his mother something along the lines of, can you get me out of maybe being Baker-acted because I want to, buy a gun? And the mom said, yeah, let him have it. It wasn't so much of a big deal. So I don't know if that's super surprising, but it is kind of shocking how, we see a little bit more of how his mother was involved in his education.
The judge last week says there wasn't any concern about the shooter's private medical information being made public. A lot of information, as you mentioned, was blacked out. But why is that? Why do they do that?
Yeah, so they do it mostly for two federal privacy laws called FERPA and HIPAA. FERPA has to do with education, blocking out, your educational information is private, and that goes all the way up until you're in college. You can't have that release. And also HIPAA comes into play here. HIPAA is the federal law that protects medical information being out there. And HIPAA is also involved here because the report also goes into Cruz's medical history and his affiliation with, behavioral health, Henderson Behavioral Health. And they do talk about mental health assessments in this report.
So we find out a little bit more about what we know, but a little bit more about who this shooter is. So what did we learn about how the school district handled him? And maybe it gives us insight into how they handle these kind of students.
Well, he was, it's interesting because Cruz, at age 3, when he was in pre-K, his mom actually requested a meeting that, you know, maybe he needs some special education services. So he's been a special education student since he was 3 years old. They worked with him. There were some ups and downs. He made progress. Then they kind of lifted off restrictions. Then he got way worse and at one point racked up like 28 referrals between August and January while he was in middle school. Then they had to put on more restrictions. But then you can kind of see what I think is the most interesting part of the of this, you know, 20-page section is that he they wanted to take him out of Stoneman Douglas and move him back into a special education school, but he tried to reject that. He said he didn't want to go to an ESC school. I guess he didn't like the stigma of that, did not want to return. And the school district kind of had to kind of plead with him, but they said the only way you can stay at Stoneman Douglas is to revoke your special education status, which he was 18 at the time, and as an adult, you can do that. You can refuse special education services, and he did just that, just to stay at Stoneman Douglas. Later, though, his grades were terrible. He was still getting in trouble, and Stoneman Douglas, almost at that point, it seemed like a last resort. They almost had to, you know, they really, really asked him to leave, and at that point, he did. So it's interesting just seeing how, you know, kind of like where the buck stopped. And I believe that was around 2017. It's interesting, though, that a lot of these big educational decisions kind of happened all in the month of February. I just thought that was an interesting coincidence.
And did it say anything about the Promise program? Did that pop up?
No. And the report doesn't really touch on discipline. It mentions just, you know, how many referrals he racked up. It doesn't go into a lot of detail about Promise. Promise, I believe, is only mentioned, you know, a handful of times, just because, you know, it kind of gave reason for, you know, that this is maybe why you should be moved out of your zoned traditional middle school into, you know, an alternative school. But no, the only really mention of Promise is when he vandalized the bathroom in his middle school. And after that, you know, he got moved on to an alternative school, which he actually made a lot of progress at, according to this report.
I'm talking with Colleen Wright, reporter for the Miami Herald. We're talking about the release of the education records report that came out, Broward County School District did, on the confessed Parkland shooter. A judge last week said that information can be public. There was information on that report, by the way, that was blacked out. It was redacted, but we ended up finding it. We ended up seeing it anyway. Colleen, what is the district's response as to, you know, everything that's come about these last couple of days?
Sure. So this report came out. It was a Friday evening news dump. It came out at 5 p.m. on Friday, and that is actually significant in and of itself because the Broward School District was off on Fridays in the summer. They were off on Friday. They were not supposed to be working. But, of course, they released that report when I tweeted how, you know, look at all this redaction. The report says, you know, the school district, you know, did no wrong. There was only two small recommendations. But, of course, what led to that was all redacted. Then, like I said before, Emily Block, you know, found a way, you know, that it actually wasn't redacted. If you paste it into a Word document and it was all there. Now the link is broken to that report. If you were to go onto the press release and click the link to the report, it's broken. They haven't issued any other subsequent statement. As far as I know, we haven't gotten a cease or desist letter or anything coming from the school district to not publish this information about Cruz. It's been radio silence coming from the Broward County School District.
And my understanding, I think, is they redacted a lot of information because, again, of the law you were talking about privacy, medical medical information, right?
Yes, yes. Although they needed to protect Cruz's educational and health information. I mean, he's still protected under those laws.
And so now the defense team is claiming, well, they were claiming from the beginning that this information could hurt their chances for a fair trial. But just from reading the information, you know, and I understand you don't cover the courts, but I mean, what information are they concerned about?
I guess he does come off as a troubled kid. I don't know if this information necessarily, if you didn't know the name of whose it was, you know, if this would lead to someone who would later be, you know, conduct the largest mass shooting and mass school shooting in Florida. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's a lot of information, but it does seem like the school district, you know, there's a line in here where they're saying, you know, how could a student rack up 28 referrals in 4 or 5 months and not be kicked out. And he was a special education student. That means he was entitled to those services. So I don't know if people say maybe there is more that could be done to stop him, or, you know, he was a troubled kid and he didn't get help. I don't know what kind of, what kind of reason. I'm sure they just want to limit the amount of information out there as to not maybe, you know, sway or prejudice jurors.
The decision by the court, by the way, was based, I believe, on a lawsuit from the news media, I think included the Miami Herald and the Sun Sentinel, right?
Yes, yeah. So we've been involved in lawsuits for some time, just trying to get as much information we can get. We've succeeded on some, not, you know, or some are just kind of stuck in appeals. You know, we were supposed to get videos of external video of shooters out, or I'm sorry, the officers outside of Stoneman Douglas that day on February 14th earlier this year, and you know, we were supposed to get those videos, but then the, you know, school district blocked it. So, you know, it's kind of just this ongoing, crusade to get this this information.
Colleen Wright, again, education reporter for the Miami Herald, talking about this report that a judge last week decided that a report on the confessed shooter, Parkland shooter, is public, should be made public, and that information is out there now. Colleen, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Also wanted to mention, too, that the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission is meeting again this week. This is a commission that was put together by the governor, made up of a lot of different people to discuss issues of school safety, campus safety, and really what happened in February. They're meeting again the 8th and the 9th of this week. It's a story that we'll obviously be keeping our eyes on. All right, coming up, former U.S. Senator Bob Graham will talk movies and a little politics with us. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, former Florida Senator and Governor Bob Graham has certainly left his mark on the state. He was essential in restoring the state's economy as governor following the 1970s recession and passing the Everglades Comprehensive Restoration Plan as senator. Senator Graham was also a champion for Florida's film industry, which at one point competed with the likes of California and New York. For these contributions, Graham is being presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival this Wednesday. He joins us now in studio to talk movies. We'll talk some Florida politics. We'll talk a little bit of a lot of things. Senator Graham, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much.
So you found yourself back in the political sphere. I got to start with this because, of course, your daughter, Gwen Graham, is campaigning for governor. You know, and the latest polls have her actually very close lead, tied for the lead with Philip Levine. What are the biggest differences in the current political atmosphere in this campaign compared to when you were doing this back in the 1970s?
I'd say there were three main differences. One, partisanship. When I started in the legislature in 1966, it was almost all Democratic, and it had been since the end of Reconstruction. In 1966, something happened that had not occurred in well over a half century, and that is a Republican was elected governor, Claude Kirk. That began the process which has led to today, when we've now had 20 years of straight Republican governors in Florida. So a change in the political makeup of the state. Second is the change in the state itself. Florida was half the size that it is today when I was first elected to the legislature, and is much more diverse than it is. So it's more politically complicated than it used to be. And third is the money. When I ran for the legislature, I spent less than $20,000. When I ran for governor, in 40 years ago, in 1978, I spent about $6 to $7 million to run in a first and second Democratic primary and then in a general election. Today, $6 or $7 million will hardly get you a seat at the table. So those are some of the major differences.
And of course, Florida has for a number of years now been one of these key states nationally. They're watching the Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson. They're watching this governor's race. This is going to be really big. Florida, was it even on the map? Were people considering it back when you were running for governor and for senator?
Yeah. Not only has Florida grown, doubled in population, it's now the third largest state in the nation, and it is the most competitive of the large states. California is Democratic. Texas is Republican. New York is Democratic. It's only Florida of the top four states that is a purple competitive state.
Was it? But you know what? We think about people always like to say, oh, my God, look how ugly politics has gotten. But really, politics is tough. It's cutthroat, right? It was ugly, too, wasn't it?
And particularly when you get down to the last few weeks and days of the campaign, it tends to become uglier as candidates who see themselves lagging in the polls turn to negative positions ads in order to try to close the gap.
What was it like for you, especially in the primary? Because that's where you find your daughter now. This is the primary season now.
Yeah. I loved campaign, and one of the things I did when I ran for governor was to take different jobs. I took over 100 jobs while I was running for governor in 1978, and that made the campaign for me much more than just the traditional political things you do. It was a real learning experience as I got an insight into what people did for a living. In many cases, I would spend the night with the person I was going to work with the night before so that I would meet their family, children, get a broader understanding of what influenced them, as well as learned a lot about what it means to be a flight attendant on an airline or a nurse in a psychiatric hospital or all the other things.
It was very hands-on for you is what it was. You know, obviously the biggest thing is the fact that today we live in this world of social media and Twitter and Facebook. And you think about the fact that it's great because people can communicate directly with their constituents as to where before you do something like this, you'd come to the radio station, do an interview. But of course, we've also seen how it could be pretty ugly as well. I mean, how do you think you would have handled Twitter and Facebook back in the times when you were running for governor?
Well, I hope I would have handled it well. It was not around when I was active in politics. My daughter, who is now running for governor, Gwen Graham, she's become quite adept, agile in the use of social media, and I'm learning a lot from her.
You know what? As we come up near to the primaries, again, the race is getting very tight, especially for the Democrats, because there are five candidates. But you know what? Going into this election season, it's a midterm, usually not a big turnout, though people are expecting this one to be different. Do you think so?
Yes. There is some early evidence in terms of the absentee voting, which is going on now, vote by mail. Seems to be stronger than it has been in previous off-presidential year elections. And I think there is and maybe it's some of President Trump's influence, maybe it's some of the rapid changes that are occurring in the economy, that there is more interest in politics today than there has been in recent years, and that's going to reflect in a larger voter turnout.
As you said, though, it's Republicans have controlled the governor's mansion and the legislature for some time now. Does that change? Do you think it could change this year?
It could change. If I could use the example of my daughter had been working for the Leon County, that's Tallahassee school system, and in 2013, she became dissatisfied with the person that was representing her in the U.S. Congress and decided that she was going to take him on. Now, she was not given a lot of encouragement because that was a very conservative district. The man who held the position was a Tea Party Republican and had been quite popular. But she decided to run a campaign of outreach to every voter that she could talk to and won. And I might say that she's the only candidate for governor on the Democratic side who's ever defeated a Republican in a competitive election. And I think she can apply some of those same skills to this current governor's race.
What do you think is the big issue? Democrats, any Democrat is going to have to press really hard to have a chance to win.
Well, I think there are a cluster of issues. One big issue is health care. The Republicans have made it a very major part of their platform to repeal Obamacare and have been fairly shaky as to what they would do in a post-Obamacare. My daughter has said we ought to expand Obamacare in Florida. We should take the opportunity to reach almost a million Floridians by expanding Medicaid, that we also ought to do some other things such as have a reinsurance plan that will pick up the most expensive person's health care and therefore reduce the pressure on insurance premiums for everybody else. Education is a very high priority for her. She's worked in education. It has been a major issue of concern throughout her lifetime, and she has a very aggressive program as to what we can do in Florida. When I was governor, our goal was to be in the top quartile, the top 25% of the states in terms of education. Today, on one standard, teacher salaries, we're 45th of the 50 states. So we've dropped a long way in 40 years, and she's committed to bringing us back to where we should be.
And that primary, again, is coming up at the end of this month. Let's go back to, you know, your time as governor. And, you know, as I mentioned, you're being awarded this Wednesday for your contributions to the film industry in Florida when you were governor. I'm curious how you got interested in this issue. And is it true that you actually worked on a Burt Reynolds movie once?
Yes, I was a grip on a movie that Burt Reynolds made. The day I spent on the set was in Fort Lauderdale, where the Burt Reynolds sidekick was being murdered by the bad guy in the movie. And they filmed his assassination three different ways. Fairly mild murder, a little bloodier murder, and then just a slaughter. And I asked, why did we do it three times? And they said, depending on the audience. One audience will get the soft version and other audiences will get the massacre.
And what, by the way, what's a grip? Remind people, what is a grip?
What
were you doing?
What I was doing was moving equipment. They had like a little railroad track and you push the camera back and forth to get the right angle for the particular shot.
Why did you think as governor that the movie industry was going to be so important to the state?
I thought it was important to the state first because Florida has as one of its largest economies tourism, and the movies are sort of a free postcard that you can send to the world about what Florida is like. Miami Vice was for many years a very popular program, and that preceded a time in which South Beach was thought of as only a place for older Americans. It was not a very electric or exciting place. Miami Vice played a very critical role in changing public attitude towards South Beach and contributing to what South Beach is today, an international tourist destination.
What did you think about that? I remember growing up with that show, and it was a fun show and a very popular show. Granted, it was right after really the cocaine cowboy era, and they were, I mean, it was about, you know, these two cops that were dealing with the cocaine issue and with crime. But yeah, it did paint Miami in a different light. That's true. But I mean, you know, did you ever worry because it was a crime show and it kind of, you know, kind of portrayed, you know, gangsters and that lifestyle a certain way that maybe it could be bad?
And it maybe it did have some connotations that direction, but it fundamentally changed the idea of what South Beach was. And so it's one thing the movies have done is they have made Florida known to places. For instance, there was a Fonda movie about growing Tupelo Honey on the Apalachicola River. Probably most people never heard of either Tupelo Honey or the Apalachicola River, but that movie made that section of Florida suddenly a place that people wanted to go to.
Was that a Gene Fonda movie?
No.
Henry Fonda.
Henry Fonda.
Henry Fonda. Okay. I'm not remembering what that is. It was way before my time, but I'll find that in a minute. How did you do it, though? How did you convince, you know, movie production companies out of L.A., hey, come to Florida. This is a great place for yeah. business.
Well, for one thing, as governor, I made many trips to particularly Hollywood, also some to New York, to encourage production companies to think about doing it in Florida. One of the unexpected results of that, I got to have some strong relationships at Universal Studios, and they were seeing the beginnings of Disney in Orlando, and they said, we want to get some of this action too. And so in that case, we didn't get a movie, but we got a major entertainment center in the middle of the state. So the personal activity and personal commitment to assist in making these productions successful. Another thing that's important are the jobs. And it's not only the jobs that the movies hire specifically, but the job skill sets that are created in the community. One of the reasons that Florida has been a popular place for commercials, both television commercials and magazine commercials, grows out of the very deep skill set that came here with the motion picture industry. So those are all some of the reasons why I thought it was important to encourage film production in Florida. And at one time in the 1980s, we actually produced more movies in Florida than California.
And that's not the case now, because now the companies love to go to Louisiana, Atlanta, New York, or Canada. And so, I mean, we're not really that high on the list anymore.
Yeah,
can we get that back?
We can, and we can do it by giving the industry the kind of support that they were getting back in the 80s. Now, I mentioned some of that is direct encouragement by state leadership. Some of it is having a deep squad of talented people to support the industry. Another part of it is incentives. Georgia, for instance, gives a 20% rebate on the taxes that a motion picture company would spend, such as sales tax, as an inducement for them to produce in Georgia. And as a result of that, Georgia has spiked to the top position in terms of film production in America.
I'm speaking with former Florida Senator and Governor Bob Graham. Graham is being presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Florida International Film Festival for his contributions to the film industry during his time as governor. We're talking film, politics, we're talking about a lot of things. I wanted to come back to this. When you were senator, you were essential in the passage of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. First, explain the implications of that plan in maintaining the health and security of the Everglades.
I grew up in the Everglades. I grew up in a little town that no longer exists called Pensuco, Florida, which was an island in the Everglades. So my first life experiences were around all the things that constitute the Florida Everglades. When I got into politics, I recognized the pressure upon the Everglades, and that it was a declining resource. And when I became governor in the 1980s, I established what was called the Everglades Restoration Program. When I got to the Senate, I made as one of my goals to get the federal government to join the state of Florida in this effort. That happened in the year 2000. And since that time, the state and the federal government, particularly the Corps of Engineers, have been collaborating on the most extensive civil works project that the United States has undertaken since the Panama Canal.
And as you said, I mean, when you were governor, the state was half the size in population. And here we have this growing state, and cities are just starting to press deeper and deeper, closer to the Everglades. So we have that situation here, as you know, a couple of big developments. One, the big one, though, that is starting to creep up on the edge of the Everglades is this American Dream Mall, which is close to home for you. Graham Companies own a portion, I believe, of the land where that mall, the mall is going to be built around there, correct?
We had owned land. We do not currently have any land that's in the area of the mall.
What's your take on this? The construction that now starts to edge closer, and it's not on the Everglades, but we're now edging closer to the Everglades, and we're near that boundary that we had built that was supposed to protect from getting any further out west.
Yeah, well, I will commend Dade County. They have established an urban boundary. You cannot build west of that, and that urban boundary is more or less U.S. 27. Now, this particular project is about 5 to 6 miles east of the urban development boundary. But I think by providing that kind of a protection for activity and separation from the Everglades itself is an important part of achieving the goal of Everglades restoration.
Are you worried about any of the wetlands in between that boundary and the Everglades that we might have an impact on that in a negative way?
Well, most of that area that's towards the far edge of U.S. 27 is now in what's called the Lake District, where it's being mined for a variety of purposes, primarily transportation and construction.
What do you think of the past governors? I mean, Governor Scott, Governor Crist, going back even to Governor Bush, in what they've done for the Everglades and Everglades restoration?
I think Governor Bush was a very good governor for Everglades restoration. He was the governor at the time the state-federal compact was achieved. I'm afraid Governor Scott hasn't shown that level of interest in the Everglades, particularly in what is the major current challenge, which is to develop a sufficient capacity to store water south of Lake Okeechobee so that it can then go through a treatment process before it's released into the central and southern part of the Everglades and eventually into Florida Bay. The current issues about blue-green algae are directly related to the inability to have that system to release water to the south, so it's going to the east and west and causing considerable damage in places like Lee County and Martin County, where they have now suffered 2 or 3 years of heavily polluted water.
I can't let you go without asking you about, in recent years, you've devoted a lot of your time to civic duty and getting individuals more engaged in their communities. First, tell us about your desire for greater civics education and the value that it has on a young person's life.
Yeah. Florida, like most other states, stopped teaching civics 20 or 30 years ago. And I think we're paying the price for it now. Some of the things that we don't like about government go back to the fact that so few of our citizens have had a formal introduction to it, an understanding of what it means to be a citizen in a democracy. I am pleased to say that Florida in 2010, by action of the legislature, restored the civics in the classroom. I've been working to support that effort. For instance, I have written a book called America, the Owner's Manual, and have established at the University of Florida a center immodestly called the Bob Graham Center for Public Service to, again, provide assistance to both the higher education and the public schools in developing the next generation of citizens for Florida and America.
And you published that book in 2008. Interestingly, you republished it because you had to add a segment on social media.
That's right. When we wrote the book, and the "we" is my co-partner, Chris Hand, There was no social media. 5 years later, it had become a significant part of the way in which you communicate in a democracy. So we wrote a second edition of the book, which gave that appropriate heavy emphasis to how do you effectively use social media to advance your democratic objectives.
Let's finish up on this. I wanted to know your take on how can Tallahassee achieve bipartisanship when we talk about critical challenges right now, like sea level rise, gun violence, and the teacher education issues in general, whether it's teacher pay or teacher shortages. How do we do that?
One thing we do is follow the lesson of my daughter. In her term in Congress, was selected by Georgetown University, which rates all the members of Congress on their ability to reach across the aisle and to, in a bipartisan spirit, get things accomplished. She was rated as not only the most effective of the 27 members of the Florida delegation, but the eighth most effective of all 435 in Congress. So what are some of her lessons? One is you start by asking the question, what is it we are trying to accomplish? And once you get people to agree that these are the definitions of success, you find out that there aren't that many alternatives as to how to get there. Second lesson is you park your ego at the front door. Everybody can have their own opinion, but nobody can have their own facts.
All right, I have to stop it there because of time. He is former Florida Senator and former Governor Bob Graham, again being presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Florida International Film Festival for his contributions to the film industry during his time as governor. Senator Graham, thank you so much. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you,
thank you so much. And you know what? Love to have you back as this political season just churns up. It's just going to get more interesting.
Yeah. Interesting it will be.
Definitely. All right. Coming up next, what is K-pop? We're going to meet a YouTube star, JRE. He's going to tell us all about it. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Set up cameras, react, edit, and repeat. Do this well enough, and you just might rack up a million followers on YouTube. Miami native JRE is a K-pop YouTuber. He records himself reacting to K-pop music videos, and then he uploads those on YouTube. An editorial note, by the way, JRE has requested we do not use his real name for privacy and security concerns. K-pop or Korean pop is growing in popularity, with boy band BTS making history last month as they topped the Billboard 200 chart with their album Love Yourself, Tear. Behind the growing popularity of K-pop is a massive online remix culture. YouTube is home to countless dance covers, song mashups, vlogs, and other parodies. One branch of this subculture, as I mentioned, is reaction videos, in which people record themselves reacting to these K-pop music videos. Now, most of this creative community is located in Los Angeles or New York, but JRE KML is one of the oldest and most popular K-pop reaction video channels, with over a million subscribers, again, based here in Miami. The channel's host, producer, Miami native JRE, joined us in studio. We began by asking him to describe what exactly is K-pop.
K-pop is literally pop music, but in Korean. It's like the basic thing. Like, if you think pop music in general, but just put Korean in it, it's K-pop. You can have C-pop, T-pop, P-pop for Philippines, since I'm half Filipino. Yeah, literally, Korean pop.
Korean pop music.
Yeah.
How long has it been around?
Since 70s, way back when.
So it goes back a while.
It goes back.
But it hasn't really become a U.S. sort of phenomenon until what, recently?
Let's see, I mean, K-pop is always through the internet. I mean, since the internet was born, that's how people got access to it. So I got into it more like 2010, 2011, but I know people that got into it way back when, like when the internet was still fresh.
So as much as you've been listening to it, can I say, do you have a favorite K-pop song or artist?
Artist, I'm pretty loyal to how I got into K-pop. So Big Bang, they're called Big Bang from the company called YG Entertainment. That got me into K-pop, and I'm forever like loyal to them. I guess I'm a loyal person in general. So yes, K-pop, Big Bang. That's my group.
You know what? Because I said you're a K-pop YouTuber. How do you describe to people what is a YouTuber?
A YouTuber? I don't know. I remember someone explained to me that YouTube or social media, like there's TV, there's movies, and then I think someone called it like snack media. Like, it's an interesting way. And when I think of it, yeah, it is like snack media. But now it's becoming a thing where it's taken more seriously, where you can actually make money from it. And there's been YouTubers that make millions from it. And hopefully I'm one of those one day. But at the minute, I'm doing all right. But YouTube,
because this isn't a hobby. This is your job, right?
Yeah, it became my job. It was a hobby at first. Then I started taking it more seriously. Then there's the business end of YouTube. And then, you know, sponsors here and there that you can make money from. And yeah, here I am.
So you're making these K-pop reaction videos? Is that?
Yes. That's what I'm known for.
Okay. So watching the video, we're going to hear a clip in a second, but watching these videos, I mean, you're watching videos and you have these wonderfully funny reactions to what you're watching. You're just commentating on what you're watching, right?
Basically, yeah.
Where did that come from?
I mean, reaction videos has been there for, I think, even before me. And just reacting to K-pop and music videos, I don't know why I started it. I think I was just like, you know, because in Miami, there's not a big K-pop community. And I was just seeing if anyone else is just like me. So I literally put my face out there.
So you basically, again, this is your YouTube channel, is you are watching these K-pop videos mm-hmm. and reacting to them. You know, as you said, I mean, this is kind of niche, right? Because
yes.
It's K-pop is still kind of growing in popularity here, right?
Yeah.
In the United States.
United States, yeah.
All right, so I want to play a clip from one of your most watched videos.
Oh,
this is where you react to BTS's song, Fake Love.
Wow.
You're in this room, in your room where you're yes. watching this music video, and you're live commenting. Let's listen.
Oof.
The floodgates just opened up? What the? Explosion? That's a dope shot, by the way. Yo, BTS always be doing that. Yo, just stop the music, tell you a little story, then go back into the chorus. For like, ooh, oh, he did pull up his shirt, did. I don't know if he did it before, but I just saw that, abs.
All right, tell me what's going on here. This is really funny.
It's, I've seen, it's interesting listening to myself, actually. Literally, I'm reacting to BTS, Fake Love. That's actually pretty new, by the way. I'm literally commenting on what I see and adding my humor or whatever you want to call it. Whatever comes out of my mouth, it happens. Like, I just commented on his abs. I'm like, yo, he showed abs. I have to comment on it.
How many takes do you do?
Oh, one.
One to, it's just one take. You turn it on.
I literally wait for it to come out. Just first reaction.
Do you watch it before you do the tape?
No.
You're commenting on a first watch.
First watch.
That's why it could be so spontaneous. Then.
Yeah.
You started doing this, what, back 2011, right?
Yes, 2011.
I mean, what was that moment? What did you say, hey, let's try this? What was the inspiration?
I was a K-pop fan before, like maybe a year before. I got into K-pop, and I literally wanted to see if anyone else on YouTube or anyone could relate to what I liked. Because especially in Miami, I didn't know who – I didn't have anyone that's like my – you know, a friend that likes K-pop. I had my cousin named KML who started the channel with me. And we got into K-pop together, but it's just spontaneous.
When you put that first video out – how many people were watching it? What kind of reaction did you get?
I remember I didn't even know how to put a picture-in-picture and editing at the time. So it's hard to watch for me because it's just me and my face reacting to nothing. You just see my face. But I think it got like 5,000 views at that time.
That's
a lot.
That is a lot.
Especially for a channel that has no like subscribers or anything. So
I mean, that's got to be addictive, like, wow, people are watching, maybe I could do more.
Yeah, and it was fun because I'm literally just watching something I like and people like watching in my commentary, so I guess as long as everybody's happy.
How long did it take before you hit the million subscribers?
Ooh, a million, I say up to coming to my fifth and sixth year, that's when I hit a million. And that was a big moment.
I'm curious as to when you got into K-pop because so you're a Miami native. Your
yes.
mother's from the Philippines. Your father's from Jamaica.
Yes.
All right. When did K-pop come into your life?
Okay. So looking at like I'm basically half Asian and half and Jamaican. So my half Asian side, you know, in Jamaica, I look up to Bob Marley. My Asian side didn't know what to look up towards musically. So at that time, I was into R&B. There's Usher, Neo, and there was an artist named Tae Young who has a similar style. So I started looking on YouTube, and YouTube was a big part of it too. The internet was. So literally typed up, like, let's say I put Asian Usher, and Tae Young popped up, which led me to Big Bang. Then I just kept on. It's like a snowball effect.
And so the Asian Usher,
yeah,
is...
I don't know if I would say he's the Asian Usher, but that's what popped up. That's what popped up.
People are wondering, how does this work? How do you make a living as a YouTuber? Is it you have to have a million followers? Or, I mean, when do you get to that point where, like, hey, this is viable? This isn't just a hobby.
I feel like in today's YouTube, subscribers, it does mean a lot, but I think views is what means a lot because that's how you get paid off. But that's as a YouTuber. K-pop YouTube, it's kind of a tricky thing because you are, if you're doing reactions, there is a thing called copyright and there's also fair use. So I don't make money off my reactions. I don't know about anybody else, but I don't. And I always get lucky because some of the companies, they're fine with me doing this.
I'm talking with J.R.E. Dre. He is a K-pop YouTuber living here in Miami. He's from Miami. He's a Miami native. But he has been swimming in this world of K-pop for a number of years now. And he's got over 1 million subscribers on his YouTube channel. And by the way, we have a link so you can go check it out. They are quite funny, very interesting. But he is trying to bring that K-pop culture to South Florida. You know, I wanted to know about this viral culture because so much on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter, you know, anything social media, it's sometimes about going viral. And if something picks up, then it just explodes everywhere. Everybody wants to talk about it. But how do you describe that viral culture? And are you part of that?
Viral? I don't know what viral means sometimes because a viral could just be a cat video. Viral could be, you know, just like an iPhone video. It could be, it doesn't have to have a production or anything. It's hard to tell what's going to go viral and what's not.
You've been at this now really for a number of years.
Yes.
And, you know, in this world where things go viral and disappear right away, I mean, longevity is not easy to do. But how have you maintained that longevity in this business?
Literally being consistent. I think YouTube is about consistency, but in K-pop, it's hard. It always updates, so I try to keep up with it. Also, I do other videos because I know people are not really into reaction videos as well. So I did skits, I did vlogs, I did unboxings. So I did a lot of things over the years of doing. I did trial and error videos like where like some worked, some didn't. So it's literally a process. So over the years, I guess that's how I slowly growed into what I am now. I try to stand out from all the other reaction channels or K-pop channels.
You are on the road a lot now. You're getting invited to conferences, festivals.
Yes.
So, I mean, what's that like now? This goes back to this idea that you are becoming, well, you are. You've become a celebrity in this field. Is there a memorable moment in all this traveling, all this that's happened to you?
Literally, every time I meet up with people that watch my videos and tell me how much they, like, you know, makes their day, that's a memorable moment. I mean, it sounds cheesy, but each time that happens, I'm like, all right, it inspires me to make different types of videos and stuff, like, you know, to make their day because, you know, I would never expect this to be a thing.
You get a plaque from YouTube.
Yes, I did.
When you hit the 1 million subscribers.
Yes.
We have a clip. This is from a recent video, and you were thanking your fans for support so far.
When I first started, there was 5 K-pop channels or K-pop reaction channels. Now there's a lot of y'all. And that's dope. That just shows how big of a growth K-pop is. But it also becomes saturated as well. I'm not really saying that I'm gonna stop doing reactions, but I'm gonna calm down a little bit. I do want to focus on more things. See, before I started YouTube, I was a film student. I want to shoot documentaries. My passion is to shoot documentaries. My passion is to go behind the camera, not in front of it.
You were a film student.
Yes.
You know, where did you study?
Miami-Dade College, North Miami.
And so what do you, I mean, this is now, you want to go into this now. This is, you're taking another step in your career now.
Yes. I mean, I've, like I said, I've always been known for my reactions. I also did other videos too, which appeal to other people. But I kind of want to focus more on like behind the scenes. Behind the camera, of course, I've always been in front of the camera. I kind of want to just concentrate on my, like, more documentaries, a more, tell a story instead of just commentating and, like, you know, whatever's in my mind, but just tell it a different way.
So do you want to keep doing what you're doing and try at documentaries and other storytelling, or is it time for JRE to go in a new direction completely?
A little bit of both. I know I'm not going to stop because I like what I do. Reaction videos are reaction videos. They're pretty easy to do. I always know I could have time to do a reaction video. I just want to tell them, like, you know, I'm going to slow down a bit. Because K-pop, especially in the K-pop world, it's always updating 24/7. In my channel, I have, like, so many videos. I have, like, 1,500 or 2,000 almost. And that's me trying to keep up with K-pop. So, you know, I just want to slow down and then just make something that takes time.
You can find him on YouTube, the channel JREKML. By the way, JRE stands for...
Just Random Every Day. And also, they're my initials to my name, but I keep that a secret.
What's KML?
It could be Korean music love or K-pop music love.
JREKML. Good find him. He's got more than a million subscribers. K-pop YouTuber. Man, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, that's K-pop reaction video star JRE. As we mentioned, JRE has requested we do not use his real name for privacy and security concerns. And again, you can see a video of his step-by-step creative process from YouTube. It's on our website, WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.